Hey, howdy, space nerds. Thanks for tuning in each week as we explore space exploration. Don't let the conversation stop when you reach the end of this episode. Let's keep chatting online. We've launched a new Facebook page to host discussions and share the latest space news. Find us by searching Are We There Yet Podcast or visiting facebook.com/AWTYMars. I'll see you there. From the studios at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, this is the Space Exploration Podcast that asks the question, are we there yet? Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Before we send humans to Mars, it's probably a smart idea to do a few test runs first, right? Well, that's what analogs are for. They're a great way to test the human aspect of space exploration, like how do people behave while isolated, and how do team dynamics develop in a Mars simulation. High Seas is one of those analogs. It stands for Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, and it's a habitat on an isolated Mars-like site on the Big Island of Hawaii. The habitat's about 1,200 square feet, has a small sleeping quarter for a crew of six, it's got a kitchen, laboratory, simulated airlock, and, of course, a bathroom. The location also has a geology similar to Mars, so a crew can perform geological tasks just as if they were on Mars. They have to suit up in an airlock and use spacesuits to step outside. Each mission in High Seas looks to test the human factors of a Mars mission. The last mission, High Seas 5, was an 8-month stay for six test subjects. One of those subjects was Brian Ramos. He's a Portuguese-American pursuing a life of exploration. He grew up in Rhode Island and holds dual engineering degrees in biomedical and electrical engineering. And Brian joins us to talk about his time at High Seas via Skype. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First of all, how the heck did you get involved in the High Seas mission?
I got my master's at the International Space University in Strasbourg, France, where I met a lot of incredible people, and I started learning about analogs. And I had an interest in habitats in general because I did habitat design in my internships at the Johnson Space Center for NASA. And so it was kind of always on my bucket list. And then I saw an advertisement and threw my name in the hat and ended up getting selected.
So let's talk about these analogs. There's all sorts of different analogs for space exploration, but High Seas is pretty interesting. Go ahead and give us the rundown. What is High Seas and what is it an analog of?
Sure. So High Seas is primarily a psychological study. So they're looking at challenges that astronauts are going to face psychologically on a future Mars mission. And they're trying to understand those problems so that they can create mitigations for them. And also our mission was also looking at astronaut selection. So how do you select astronauts that are going to succeed in this type of environment?
So what were some of the things they looked at when you were being interviewed for High Seas?
Right. So that's actually kind of tough for us to speak to because we weren't part of any of the selection process. So we kind of were behind that wall a little bit. But I can tell you as far as my process, I mean, it began pretty normally, resume and essays and those sort of things. And then they did have, kind of test to see how fast you were on your feet. And we had to do an interview over, it was an interview, but your answers were recorded and sent in rather than actually speaking to an individual. They did, some more like psych evaluation. So you're kind of asked these odd questions and you're not really sure what they're going for. So there were a few different stages throughout the process.
And how long was that interview process?
Oh, I forget. It was over the course of a couple months. Okay. I think it was about 3 months worth. Sporadically, they would kind of send, okay, you've made it to the next stage. Now we're going to do this as you move on.
So you go through these various stages of crazy questions and all these different essays you have to write. You get the call. They say, Brian, we want you on High Seas 5. What's going through your mind at that point?
Yeah, it's an interesting call because – you know, you're sitting there and the entire time you're going, yeah, I'd love to do this. And then when you get the call and it's real, it's a whole nother question. I was pretty excited. I was kind of torn. I was at a little bit of a crossroads in my life. But I immediately called a friend of mine who just by chance, one of the other people on the mission I knew from beforehand from school. And so I gave him a call and we talked it out. And once I knew he was on there, I was like, all right, I'm in. I have at least one person I know that I can trust in.
And so, what was that process after you accepted the mission? Did you receive any training? What was that process like?
Yeah, so first we had a phone call all together with the crew members and the researchers, and they kind of told us, you know, they opened the floor for questions, basically. And my team was fantastic. I mean, they, like, everybody organized Skype calls, and we got talking to each other. And so right off the bat, we kind of were trying to develop a comfort with one another, because otherwise – before the mission, we had about a week of training where they would tell us about the research, how to conduct it, how to go about, you know, performing the various research tasks so they get the data they need. And then we were kind of thrown in there. And it was interesting because, I was lucky enough to do some filming for the New York Times for their 360-degree video series. And so I have footage of us coming in on that first day. And, you know, we're all standing there and high-five and go, woo! But if you look at our faces, we're going like, what the heck did we get into? because a week is not, you know, in hindsight, a week is not a long time, you know, to get to know someone before locking yourself in. So it was an incredible leap of faith, I think.
So what was that like traveling from, you know, where you were living at the time, traveling out to Hawaii and like that drive to the habitat? What was that like?
I think you could feel the mood change a little bit. You know, we were all kind of we clicked pretty quickly, our teammates and I. But, you know, you saw the jokes kind of starting to feel a little bit more nervous and, you know, get a little more serious. And then when we were outside, you kind of it was hard to decide when the moment was right to go inside. You know, you were kind of trying to take in the air and it's a beautiful view out there. Even though it's just kind of lava for miles, you know, you're taking in the fresh air. You're just trying to experience it one last time before you go in because, you know, you're not going to feel, you know, the wind on your face for 8 months. So it was really just a matter of trying to take it all in and, you know, and have one final moment together before we went inside the hab.
And what was going through your mind in your final moment there?
I think just that, you know, I was trying to wrap your head around, you know, we're not going to see any other people for the next few months because you're there with the researchers and the people you had been spending a week with. And it's strange to see them kind of, you know, see them for one last time and say, these are the last people I'm going to see, you know, outside of these five others for months and months. And I'm not going to see another human being for a while. So just trying to wrap your head around what that might feel like in the future, because you don't know at that point.
Just hearing you describe it, I'm getting like heebie-jeebies just thinking about being you know, quarantined from my friends and my family and my coworkers for 8 months. That's insane. How did you deal with that?
You know, parts of it are actually quite nice. Like you start to realize the things that you don't need as well as the things that you do. So obviously, you know, social interaction is very, very important, but being away from things like constant social media or constant news or, you know, a lot of passive media constantly coming at you, we didn't have any of that. And so some of it was actually pretty great.
Now, were you allowed to bring anything with you, some personal items or things to do? What was in your backpack or your luggage that you brought with you?
Yeah, we were essentially allowed, you know, basically a luggage piece a piece, a person. So I brought, you know, a laptop and some photos from home and some journals and things. I've spent the last couple of years traveling quite a bit, so I'm used to traveling light. There's not a lot. It's kind of hard to pack for Mars. You know, you don't really know what you need there. But yeah, we didn't need to take much, to be honest with you.
So what was a typical day for you like? Obviously, you know, researchers are studying how you interact with each other, how you deal with the isolation, but they've got to put you through some paces. What was a work day like?
Sure. So basically, every day was really a work day. So we'd get up. We'd have our morning meeting to kind of decide what's going on for the day. Some of the days during the week, we would have EVAs where we would go out and do studies in the lava fields, usually some sort of geological research task that we were given and we had to figure out on our own how to accomplish. Sometimes that day might just be about planning that and figuring out how we're going to tackle the upcoming EVA task, prep work for that. And then we had a ton of research stuff that we had to do. Some of the research is looking at us. So it'd be things like collecting hair and spit samples to determine how stressed we are and how that changes over time, which is really interesting. Other things would be, you know, tasks like puzzles that we'd have to solve as a team. And maybe you have different team members. So they'd look at how we speak to one another while we're trying to solve those tasks. So there was a whole slew of projects. And then there were also opportunistic research that organizations would kind of propose. And so we had virtual reality systems. We had watches that would monitor, you know, when we sleep and what our sleep patterns were, things like that.
And how did you notice yourself changing, if at all, over time? Were you getting the standard amount of sleep, or did you find yourself being more stressed? How did you adapt to the situation?
To be honest with you, I found that I felt less stressed than I did in kind of the outside world, because you eliminate a lot of the noise that isn't really necessary in your day-to-day life. And even though you're doing more things, you're doing more work, it felt good because I was much more productive. And even in my free time, I felt much more compelled to do writing and compelled to kind of dive into the projects that really were really important to me, because my world was shrunken down, you know, so much.
This is a true analog in the sense that your communication was intentionally delayed to kind of simulate what it would be like if you were on the surface of Mars talking back to Earth. How did that affect you at all when you're trying to send emails or talk to mission managers?
Right. So it's there's kind of two sides to it. On one side, it's you know, positive, because you have a little bit more time to think about your words and to process things. And in a way, you kind of have an excuse to not answer somebody right away, as bad as that sounds, you know, because sometimes you're doing a ton of, you know, work tasks throughout the day. So it's nice to have that your inbox isn't filling up all the time. The flip side of that is, yeah, it has become a little bit difficult to solve a problem, because if you have an issue where you need a manual for something, some information to repair something, you know, it's 20 minutes to just let them know there's a problem. It's another 20 minutes to get that information back, and then however much time they take to gather that or just, you know, see it and answer you. So every email exchange, you know, basically pushes your solution back an hour if it's something that you really need. So that can be difficult. And it depends on the answers you get back. If you don't word, you know, if I don't word something properly where they understand it, or they give me the wrong information back, then, you know, that's another hour added onto our problem. And that can get pretty frustrating.
Did you ever get homesick?
Yes and no. As I said, I've been traveling, you know, quite a bit. So I've gotten used to kind of the beats of the emotions that I go through. So personally, it was a little bit easier for me to handle. But we also stayed in touch. I mean, we can email our friends and our family. So those kinds of things help. And it's actually shocking how important that is. You get an email from a friend that, you know, maybe you haven't talked to in a couple months, and you're just so grateful for that. It really doesn't take much other than, hi, how's it going? Things are okay. And even just somebody telling you about their day, it makes you feel tied to home.
So experiencing it firsthand and being a part of the experiment that's going to lead the way to how we treat future astronauts that are going to go to Mars, I mean, what can you see as some of the big challenges that we still have to figure out when it comes to establishing a human presence on Mars?
I'm not sure I'm the expert, you know, to be talking about that, but from firsthand experience, I would say the communication issue that you talked about, certainly I think we need to change the way we look at, you know, mission control and mission support because of those delays. The way you interact with your astronauts, I think, is going to have to be very different. There's going to be a higher level of trust and providing information more quickly. Certainly, you know, us in the space community, I always talk about, you know, the high degree of autonomy. You need to have astronauts that can handle situations. Our team was very good with that in terms of our diverse abilities. So we had, you know, a programmer from Google. We had somebody who worked modeling Indy 500 race cars. We had, you know, we had it all. So when we had a task, we had a geologist, an astrobiologist. So when we had a task, we always seemed to have somebody seemed to have a skill that we needed to tackle that. So that's very important. And then the other thing which I found interesting was that there's a lot of ways you can kind of indirectly, and again, I'm not a psychologist, but just from witnessing it, I think you can indirectly influence behavior based on, you know, just like your daily tasks or the way you design architecture. So for example, if you have a task like a chore, you know, a cleaning chore that you have to do with another person, that becomes very important because you might have a time in your day where you get frustrated when you're doing some sort of work task. But when you're working Just doing something that's mundane and you have to interact with someone, it's almost awkward if you don't speak to one another. And so that gets the conversation rolling. It provides an opportunity to address a problem that people might not be comfortable addressing otherwise. So those kinds of things, I think we need to take a closer look at.
Brian, you mentioned this at the start of the conversation, that when you were accepted to High Seas 5, you realized that there was someone that was a school colleague or an academic colleague with you. How did having that familiar face on this mission help you adjust? Do you think that had a large impact on you?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was it made me comfortable with joining the mission in the first place. I mean, I know myself, I'm pretty confident I would have joined anyway because, you know, I kind of tend to just jump in and figure it out. But it certainly added a level of comfort of, hey, I can talk to this person because I've worked with them and I was comfortable with them. And when we had worked together in school, we were kind of in reverse roles. And in this role, he was, you know, he was the commander of the mission. And so it was interesting. It was really good to see that different dynamic. And so it really helped to have an established relationship, I think.
So, Brian, what did you take away from this experience?
So something that's kind of interesting is, in general, the entire mission is basically like taking your entire world and shrinking it down to this, you know, one room essentially, so that nothing's really any different except you can't just walk away from things. So if you have an issue with someone, you can't just leave. All parts of your life are connected to one another. So the person I go to work with in the morning is the same person I'll be cooking dinner with in the afternoon, is the same person I might be watching a movie with. And so if you, you know, anything you say or any action that, you know, you do at a certain point in your life kind of domino effects through every other piece of your life. And so what that means is that you have to be very cognizant of, you know, what you do and what you say and how you treat people. And it becomes really positive because it forces you to be aware of people's emotions and thoughts and things that sometimes we kind of forget about because we can just leave. And it also forces you to have to address issues. So at the end of the day, you have to be able to sit down at a table and go, look, this is bugging me. What's bugging everybody else, and how do we adjust that together?
Has that changed the way you've approached issues you've had outside the mission in your own personal life?
I think it's approached how I treat people. Yeah, how I treat people in general. I think it's something that I was aware of a little bit more. I tended to be the person to bring up an issue at the table because, you know, some people are comfortable with just going, hey, you know, Brendan, can I pull you aside and chat for a little bit and, you know, talking one-on-one. Some people, you know, people who want to be astronauts are not people who like to complain. These are high-functioning individuals who view bringing up issues sometimes, I think, as complaining, where, you know, I don't see it the same way. So sometimes if you open up the floor and you just go, hey, this is what's bothering me, all of a sudden, you know, other people feel more comfortable in saying, well, this is what's been keeping me up at night. This is bothering me while we work. And so then you get those problems on the table and you can create mitigations for those. So I think so. I think I try to employ that, especially in work scenarios, a little bit more now.
So if we do have the opportunity to send humans to Mars during your lifetime, Brian, are you going to sign up for it?
I would absolutely love to. Yeah, I wouldn't second guess that for a second.
Wonderful. Well, Brian Ramos, he was on the High Seas 5 mission, which was an 8-month long Mars analog out in Hawaii. Brian, thank you so much. This was such a fascinating conversation.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Brian kept a blog during his time on High Seas and continues to write about exploration after the mission. You can check it out at thetravelingspaceman.com. Well, that's going to do it for this episode, but join the conversation online. We've got a Facebook page. Search for Are We There Yet Podcast. Or you can take to Twitter. The show is AWTYMars, and I'm at Space Brendan. You can also send me an email with a story idea, compliment, or a complaint. It's arewetherethyet@wmfe.org. Support for Are We There Yet comes from the listeners of WMFE. Our theme music was composed by Kevin McLeod. You can find more space news online at wmfe.org/space. And until next time, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.